Good morning. It's Saturday morning and I'm sitting here with my coffee. I'm going to read chapter 6 and possibly chapter 7. Chapter 6, Discovering Populism, A Southern Odyssey. Here's a quote from William Faulkner. You cannot swim for new horizons until you have courage to lose sight of the shore. In his history course at Harvard, Bobby came across some curious polling data. They indicated that the white mourners he had seen lining the tracks of his father's funeral train, his strong supporters in the 1968 primaries, had largely voted in 1972 not for Democratic candidate George McGovern, but for Robert Kennedy's polar antithesis and personal nemesis, Alabama Governor George Wallace. It struck me then that every nation, like every individual, has a dark side and a lighter side, Bobby said years later. I became fascinated by populism, a democratic impulse that was often perverted by demagogues. The easiest thing for a politician to do is to appeal to our greed, bigotry, racism, xenophobia, and crude self-interest. My father had endeavored to do something different, to appeal to the hero in each of us, to persuade us to transcend narrow self-interest and act on behalf of the community. Bobby remembered well his father in 1962, having led the Justice Department through a series of events that marked the greatest confrontation between the states and federal power since the Civil War. That September, on the campus of the University of Mississippi, 500 federal marshals sent by Robert Kennedy to protect James Meredith as he sought to enroll were attacked by a howling mob firing guns and hurling bricks and bottles. More than 60 were wounded after unsuccessfully begging RFK for permission to open fire to defend themselves. Instead, the Attorney General ordered Army troops moved to the campus. 8-year-old Bobby found a note from his father on his pillow the next morning. Bobby, tonight we got James Meredith into the University of Mississippi. I hope these battles are over by the time you are grown. Bobby reflected, that vision and something of my father's other qualities had evoked a powerful populist response among all types of Americans. So it was that he decided to write his junior thesis at Harvard on Governor Huey Long, the Louisiana Kingfish, and the lives of agrarian rebel Tom Watson and prairie fireball William Jennings Bryan. I admired them because they represented what de Tocqueville had described as, quote, Americans' insistence on limited government and culturally in their long-standing disdain for elites. That spirit has become one of this country's greatest gifts to the world, end quote. Each of those men had begun their careers as rabble-rousing idealists, bringing together America's poor and working people, factory workers and farmers, black and white, behind an idealistic vision. But Long had fallen into an unquenchable thirst for dictatorial power that allowed him to tolerate a great deal of corruption. Watson devolved into a Klansman, supporting the lynching of blacks and Jews. Bryant became a religious fanatic, ending his career a laughing stock for his role as an attorney attacking evolution in the Scopes monkey trial. Then, for his senior honors thesis, Bobby wanted to find a comparable Southern figure with some kind of visibility or flamboyance. He received some advice from Harvard psychiatrist Robert Coles, who had been instrumental in his father's being drawn to issues of poverty and race, having traveled with RFK to Mississippi. Why not focus on George Wallace, another powerful populist who began his career as an idealist, uniting blacks and whites, before turning to the dark side and making himself, as Alabama's governor, the national symbol of racial hatred and discontent. Bobby contemplated the idea. Although my family is invariably associated with New England, I am, in some ways, a child of the South, he would later reflect. I grew up in Virginia, so I had my own recollections of the injustice of Jim Crow. When I was a boy, I often rode in a station wagon, pulling a horse trailer across Virginia and Maryland to hunts and horse shows with my family's groom, a black man named Bill Shamwell, who would die tragically following a fall from the roof of our house. Shamwell was a proud World War II veteran who stood 6'3" and whom I recall for his tremendous physical strength and natural dignity. He enthralled me during those long drives with tales of dodging attacks by Japanese Zeros as he worked as a CB in Burma, on Midway, and Iwo Jima. When we stopped for meals, he gave me money, and I went into a roadside restaurant to buy our food. We ate together in the car. I only understood years later why it had to be that way. In 1961, if you were a black in Virginia, Alabama, or any of a dozen southern states, you had no more rights and no more protection of the law than did a black in South Africa under the system of apartheid. Bobby had followed the story of his father visiting Montgomery in 1962 to confront Wallace on his refusal to desegregate the University of Alabama. The governor had been a master of symbolic imagery, standing in the schoolhouse door pledging, "Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." But when Wallace was shot and paralyzed while running as an independent candidate for president in 1972, Ethel Kennedy had traveled to see him and even invited him to stay at Hickory Hill. Wallace declined, but didn't forget her gesture. 4 years later, he accepted Bobby's request to interview him. Accompanied by his Harvard roommate, Peter Kaplan, Bobby remembered the two drove south in my roofless Jeep, camping in a tent by the roadside. Upon arrival in Montgomery, the one-time capital of the Confederacy, I noticed on its dome the stars and bars of the Confederacy still flew, illegally, above the American flag. I stepped over the bronze star embossed in the marble atop the Capitol steps to mark the spot where Jefferson Davis had taken his inaugural oath as president of the Confederacy. I first met Wallace seated in his wheelchair in the foyer of the state Capitol building in Montgomery. Over his shoulder, I could see the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, from which a young preacher, Martin Luther King, had directed the Montgomery bus boycott. "Your daddy was a good boy," the governor told me wistfully. "They were both good boys," he repeated to conclude Uncle Jack. "They was good for this country." With that peculiar phrase, he acquitted my father of the years of vilification and acknowledged the manipulative nature of his own demagoguery. Then Wallace added, "I could never figure out how to get to them. Peter Kaplan remembered that Wallace felt compelled to explain himself politically to Bobby, trying to reconcile himself to the Kennedys, as if he felt a tremendous bond with Bobby. Bobby later wrote, "Knowing the charged political terrain of the South, Wallace's warm endorsement of my father did not entirely surprise me. This was consistent with his revised views on civil rights, which were more appealing to Alabama's newly minted black voters. But he didn't even seem to have any particular convictions on the issues about which he'd been so outspoken. He used his demagoguery for self-promotion and easily switched to the other side when it availed him. I was thinking to myself as I shook his hand of the many people who suffered to feed his ambitions, and all for what? Here now he sits in a wheelchair. Bobby and Kaplan had moved into a temporary house, and part of Bobby's itinerary involved a visit to the Alabama State Legislature. As Kaplan recalled it, for the authors of the Kennedys, Bobby's entrance brought a burst of electricity to the state proceedings. It was strikingly reminiscent of the enthusiastic reception RFK had received in 1966 at the University of Alabama. Suddenly, everyone was mobbing him, grabbing his hands and slapping him on the back, and exchanging reminiscences about his father. I'd seen him in political situations before, and he'd always acted intelligent, but a little stiffly. This time he started flashing the Kennedy smile and pumping hands in a way I'd never seen him do before. Kaplan told another writer, "To me, that was the day of Bobby's coming of age. He had a real rapport with them and he loved it. It was a completely political moment, and he saw what it was like to stand for something and be recognized for it. He was happy responding to the task of being a public person." Bobby had planned to stay only a few weeks, but while Kaplan returned to Harvard, he'd found another figure around which to focus his thesis. "Wallace, I discovered, was not really running the state," he told me. Years earlier, when a grandstanding Wallace refused to integrate the state's public high schools, a federal judge took them over. The same thing happened with the state parks and pools, mental hospitals, and transportation facilities. When a federal court found that prison conditions violated constitutional guarantees against cruel and unusual punishment, Wallace refused to rectify them, and once again the judge assumed control. In each of these cases, this man was Wallace's former University of Alabama Law School classmate, Judge Frank M. Johnson, Jr. To Bobby, Johnson's takeover represented the predictable endgame when the ginned-up hostility to government is taken to its extreme, the end of government. Frankly, there wasn't much left for Wallace to manage, and he seemed a less interesting character to me. He was all about imagery and propaganda. Bobby decided to focus his research efforts on the guy who was left holding the bag. Bobby's father had known Judge Johnson, who had worked hand in glove with RFK's Justice Department. In 1954, Johnson had presided in Alabama over the landmark Brown v. Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court to integrate the nation's public schools. He'd tried every major civil rights case in the state thereafter, including the Montgomery bus boycott, the Selma March, and the Freedom Riders. Considering himself a strict constructionist, Johnson took the Constitution and the Bill of Rights at their word, his courageous decisions making him anathema, Klansman, burned a cross on his lawn, firebombed his home. The city's wealthy denizens excluded him from the country clubs. Partially in response to the social isolation afflicting the family, Johnson's only son committed suicide. "When I met him soon thereafter, Bobby recalls, he was still quite isolated and happy for my company. Despite his reputation as a tough, uncompromising jurist who so frightened litigators, that one had famously fainted in his courtroom, I found Johnson warm, kind, and vulnerable in the best company." Bobby went on to live in Alabama for a year, visiting Judge Johnson and his wife Ruth often. He was a tall, wiry backwoodsman with droll features, homespun manners, modest humor, and laconic style. "He taught me to play golf and encouraged me to chew tobacco." Johnson kept a spittoon in his courtroom, a habit that made me a pariah when I finally returned home. We spent lots of time sharing our mutual passion for fishing and driving together to the Redneck Riviera near Pensacola and Gulf Shores to tease the mangroves for speckled trout and snook. Johnson also gave Bobby a lesson in how to effectively get things done. "I think he gave me a lot more faith in the system than I had," Bobby reflected to a radio interviewer 5 years later. "I was raised during the 1960s and participated in many of the protests. My generation grew up with the Vietnam War and very little sense of the system having any moorings in justice or equity. My work with Judge Johnson reinforced the view, which I think was also my father's, that in the end, you really could get justice through the system, and that's the only way to work." In the process, Bobby ended up moving into the home of a fellow he met at a Montgomery honky-tonk, a rangy cowboy named John Sweet Pea Russell. It became an unforgettable friendship, even though he was 10 years Bobby's senior. Bobby called Sweet Pea having a youthful outlook, a skilled storyteller with a great laugh, 6'3" of beef jerky gristle, perpetual smile, and sunny disposition that a certain kind of woman found irresistible. Sweet Pea owned the ancestral estate, a run-down antebellum mansion on almost 1,000 acres in Hainville, located halfway between Selma and Montgomery. Lowndes County had a predominantly black population, the descendants of plantation slaves. One of the first things Bobby noticed was a large portrait of Sweet Pea's grandfather on the mantel, uniformed in rebel gray. A Confederate general, he looked uncannily like Sweet Pea. In the attic was an old chest filled with stacks of Confederate currency. The general's descendant revealed to Bobby that his high school history teacher had his classmates tear Abraham Lincoln's picture out of the history books and confessed that his classmates had cheered at the PA system announcement when President Kennedy was shot. But according to Bobby's college friend, Chris Bartle, Sweet Pea treated everybody as if he was their brother. For Bobby, it was a real breath of fresh air to meet these southern white guys who didn't have a prejudiced bone in their bodies. Besides growing soybeans, Sweet Pea raised cattle, and Bobby often joined him on horseback to round up strays and rope any cows that looked to need medical attention. Using the skills he'd learned on the ranch in Columbia, Bobby was, according to Sweet Pea, just one of the boys. By that, Sweet Pea implied a wild streak that he himself cottoned to, which included Bobby's being very interested in trying how to ride a bull and bucking a horse. Sweet Pea had been taking part in Southern buck-out rodeos for some years. One of the nicest was a little more than 2 hours away in Bonifay, Florida. Sweet Pea loaded up the equipment needed, a different type of spur for bulls where you just want to dig in a little bit, grab on with your heel, and hold on with one hand. As Sweet Pea recounts, Bobby did surprisingly well. Most people who first start are off the bull before it hardly gets out of the chute with the first buck. But Bobby held on for 2 or 3 jumps and landed on his feet, which was a blessing. Because most of the time you hit on your butt or your back and you got to get up and away from the bull because he knows you're his antagonist. Well, Bobby made it to the fence and out of harm's way. I was really proud of him. Bobby's Southern education wasn't confined to outdoor activities. He spent a month observing the state legislature, then Judge Johnson in court, and having him over for dinner several times at Sweet Pea's, who found him a great guy. We just sat down and listened to him talk. The judge himself came out of the out of a wild youth filled with fast cars and bootleg moonshine that landed him in a military academy, a background with which Bobby could relate. As an article in the Miami Herald put it, some have even speculated that Kennedy and Johnson, an ironic juxtaposition of names, developed a father-son relationship during their formal year-long association. To Bobby, Johnson represented a stance of defiance, with a dedication to integrity and course that you seldom see in American politics today. Asked by an interviewer whether Johnson reminded him of his own father, Bobby replied, "I think in a lot of ways they have similar goals and ideals." Bobby even drew this comparison in 2011. Like Abe Lincoln, Judge Johnson's courage and character and his idealistic view of our nation had plunged him reluctantly to the center of the historic civil rights conflict. Bobby also came to know a number of unsung heroes of the civil rights movement, and he encountered attitudes he would never have known still existed. Despite Wallace's conciliatory rhetoric and the outward appearance of racial harmony, I sometimes glimpse the dark underbelly of racial fear and hatred waiting to be harnessed by the next demagogue. We were raised to loudly object if someone offered to tell an ethnic joke or used racial epithets, and to leave the room if it persisted. In Alabama, most people generally respected my feelings or those boundaries. At one time or another, Bobby went to all 64 counties in the state. He visited the headquarters of the Alabama Ku Klux Klan and met poor and bitter white men, burning with tribal hatred, including one who told him that Monkey Lucifer Coon had it coming. At such times, it was a painful learning experience, but through it all, Bobby made a number of lifelong friends from Alabama. One was Harris, Sugar Boy McGow, pronounced Magoo, to whom Sweet Pea introduced him 3 years earlier. He'd been a crew chief on a helicopter gunship in Vietnam, and his family owned an auto dealership in Montgomery. After spending a year at Sweet Pea's, Bobby moved into Sugar Boy's house. Sugar Boy remembers, "In the morning, when Bobby'd eat breakfast, he never looked at his food. He was reading the paper or something else all the time. If I needed to know something, all I had to do was ask him, and he'd give me the history of it. He was mainly interviewing Judge Johnson, but on weekends he was always adventurous. Bobby wasn't scared of a thing. He wasn't trying to impress anybody or prove anything, but something new, he just had to try it. Nighttime coon hunting became a favorite pastime. A black friend of Bobby's transported his hunting hounds stacked like cordwood in the trunk of his smoking Buick LeSabre, from which they would pour when we arrived at the swamp to chase the raccoons with dime store flashlights. Bobby later wrote, "I love the Spanish moss, running through the swamps and cotton fields at night with dim lights, following the baying hounds, swimming the creeks, and coming back midday with the smell of the swamp. I love the heat and humidity and climbing the moss-draped oaks in the middle of the night toward the shining eyes of a treed raccoon. I ate plenty of barbecued raccoon." Bobby didn't like to kill anything, Sugar Boy told me. When he lived with me, he caught a hawk and trained it, and same with the owl. It's kind of a shock when you walk in the bathroom before going to bed and you look up and there's an owl looking at you. Bobby and his visiting friends from back east heard the song of the South in its myriad of appearances. The Alabamans would have their eyes open too. Sweet Pea would be invited to visit the compound in Hyannisport over the 4th of July. Sugar Boy would accompany Bobby and his entourage on a couple of whitewater rafting adventures in South America and stayed at his new friend Lem Billings' apartment in New York. After Bobby largely finished his 300-page thesis on Frank Johnson, he received encouragement from Billings to consider publishing it as a book, as JFK had done with Why England Slept in 1940. After he graduated from Harvard in the summer of 1977, the editor-in-chief of Putnam signed Bobby to a publishing contract. The forthcoming book received a fortuitous boost when President Carter announced in August that Judge Johnson was his surprise choice to become the next head of the FBI. "I think he'll change the image of the Bureau and its activities so that it'll be feared by criminals, not by average citizen," Bobby told the New York Times. Although the judge's nomination had to be withdrawn after he suffered an aneurysm, the advance publicity created a stir. When Judge Frank M. Johnson, a biography, appeared, Bobby shone in his promotional appearances, including Network TV's popular Good Day program, as a remarkably handsome, charismatic, and articulate 24-year-old with no-holds-barred future ahead. Asked by TV interviewer Bill Boggs about racism in America, he responded, "I really immersed myself in Southern life for a year. I don't think it's a Southern peculiarity, what a lot of Northerners have thought for years. We're beginning to see that it's a nationwide problem and something basically that my generation is going to have to deal with. I think it's going to be a lot tougher than the kind of job that my father or Frank Johnson was involved with. I think that you have to ensure minority groups or groups that have been deprived because of prior racial injustice be given some outlet, some sense of self-direction, some sense of self-respect. And I don't think you do this just by handing out jobs or welfare money. You've got to really strengthen traditional ties, family ties, community ties, what my family was involved with over in Bedford Stuyvesant, with community projects and factories that actually have a base, not just have a 9-to-5 job with no hope of mobility. Bobby had enrolled for a brief stint at the London School of Economics, and the talk show host presumed that, like JFK, he would go on to Harvard Law School. "No, I think I'm going to go down south," Bobby replied. His father had obtained his degree from the University of Virginia Law School, which is what Bobby was contemplating. In the spring of 1979, he would rent a nondescript house in Charlottesville and commence his law school studies. "Politics seemed to me a lot more lively down south," he said. "So when Uncle Ted challenged incumbent Jimmy Carter for the presidency in 1980, Bobby's existing connections found him placed in charge of the campaign in Alabama. He was welcomed into a number of appearances in black churches where his speeches became legendary. But Ted Kennedy's challenge to Carter failed badly, and Ronald Reagan ended up defeating the Georgian easily in the 1980 presidential election." Looking back, Bobby believes that he'd gone to live in the South during a time of historic realignment. Wallace's white followers, traditional Southern Democrats, were looking for a new home. Ronald Reagan announced his 1980 presidential campaign at the Neshoba County Fair in Philadelphia, Mississippi, on the site where three young civil rights leaders had been murdered in 1964. Poking the eye of the civil rights movement with this sharp stick, a Republican National Committee member later explained it would win over George Wallace's inclined voters. Adopting Wallace's core view, Reagan proclaimed to a group of 10,000 white people, "I believe in states' rights." This, as Reagan's strategic guru Lee Atwater boasted, was a code word minted to mobilize bigots as part of the Republican Southern strategy. Reagan called the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which he'd been opposed to at the time, humiliating to the South. Bobby pointed out the opportunism at play, setting down in 2011. For 15 years, Reagan, whose acting career had fizzled, made his living as a propagandist for corporate profit-taking as chief spokesperson for the General Electric Company. With his professional delivery, starry smile, and bedside manner, he made the perfect vessel for delivering Wallace's message of hate, now wrapped in honey style and homespun patriotism. In our interview, Bobby's longtime friend Blake Fleetwood marveled that Bobby possessed a real affinity for middle-class people, white Southerners and black Southerners, everybody who was not in the top echelons. It struck me that Bobby had inherited this. I don't know where his father got that affinity, but Bobby could relate even more to people from all kinds of different paths in life. That's what's missing from the whole Democratic Party today. They've squandered it and given that affinity up to the Republican Party. And that is the end of Chapter 6. And Chapter 7 is only 3 pages, so I'm going to continue. Chapter 7, Whitewater Testing Grounds. As a boy, Bobby's heroes were not only the Catholic saints like St. Francis, there were also the explorers, Alexander von Humboldt, Charles Darwin, Burton and Speke, Stanley and Livingstone. He read everything he could about them, including the Spanish conquistadors, Cortez and Pizarro, rallying their armored men, losing bowel and bladder control as they were about to attack Atahualpa's 20,000 armed Inca warriors. In his early 20s, Bobby traveled widely in Latin America as a guide for his brother Michael's Whitewater Company. They made first descents by raft and kayak of rivers in Peru, Colombia, and Venezuela. In 1974, he and his brother David, their cousin Chris Lawford, Lem Billings, and 3 friends built a raft of giant balsa wood logs on the Apurimac River in Peru and floated the Amazon's headwaters with 2 Ashaninka Indians, Ashaninka Indians, at the end of 1979, with a contingent including his sister Carrie and several of his new friends from Alabama. They made the first successful descent down the Atorado River headwaters in Choco province along Colombia's Pacific coast, through the rainiest jungles on earth. Bobby remembered, there we encountered a tribe of black Africans who spoke no Spanish, probably descendants of slaves brought to the lower Choco in the 7th century to pan for gold, who had escaped into the jungle. Bobby's final voyage went down Venezuela's Caroni River in 1981. Each of these trips required major team-spirited undertakings to bring together everything from tents to lights, clothing, including heavy boots, not to mention food and transport. The elements were predictable. During one torrential downpour, several tents were swept away, and after the rafts were loaded, in pitch darkness, some overturned in roller coaster rapids, sending all of the group's canned goods into the river. Blake Fleetwood's journal described how in Peru they beached the rafts at night, trying to find high ground for our camp to guard against the alligator-like caimans, poisonous snakes, and packs of river rats the size of cats. Chris Lawford recalled in his memoir being on the Apurimac for 10 days and catching 100-pound catfish, which we dragged behind one of the rafts until it was decimated by piranhas when we hit some still water. And it wasn't just the treacherous waterways, Fleetwood recalled, renting a car with Bobby as the advance party. As they ascended into the high plains of Peru, Fleetwood was driving when a child dashed out onto the badly paved road in poor visibility, and the car struck the boy. I was really shaken, Fleetwood told the authors of the Kennedys. But Bobby behaved with perfect poise and calm, obviously working to live up to to the Kennedy idea of grace under pressure in the middle of this crisis. He was just 20, but he took charge right away. He jumped out and gave the kid first aid, splinted his broken leg, and carried him into the car, then drove us back to the nearest town and took the kid to the hospital. When he found out that the hospital didn't have pain-killing drugs, he went to the local pharmacy and bought some himself. He didn't leave town until it was clear that this kid was going to be okay. Later on that same trip, Billings tumbled into a ravine and badly cut his leg. Again, Bobby was able to handle crisis beautifully, using skills no one knew he had while sewing the wound up with 12 stitches. In crises big and small, Bobby carried with him the lessons he and his siblings learned from their father's boot camp for moral courage. The crew placed Lem in a prone position, luggage rack on the raft, when they set out again in the morning. In 1979, Fleetwood and Bobby made one more trip together to an Ojibwe Indian village on Canada's Rabagoon River. Fleetwood recalled a portentous moment where we saw a whole tribe being poisoned by mercury dumped into the river from a paper factory 100 miles upstream. We were shocked to see the cats dancing in circles driven mad by the mercury, and it made Bobby crazy that a corporation would be allowed to get away with killing so many indigenous families, men, women, and children, in the name of profits. One day before what would have been Jack Kennedy's 64th birthday, Lem Billings died in his sleep on May 28, 1981, of an apparent heart attack, according to the autopsy report. Billings had turned 65 a month and a half earlier. His dying wish had been for the young Kennedy men to carry his casket to the burial site. But when they arrived at the cemetery, the casket was already in place to be lowered into the ground. Led by Bobby, they picked it up and carried it around the gravesite before bringing it back to the burial plot. Lem brought Bobby through some very, very difficult periods, says Blake Fleetwood. He gave Bobby a sense of connection with his uncle and his father that Bobby did not have. He imbued in Bobby, and to some extent in all of Bobby's brothers and sisters, the sense that they were here on this earth for a purpose. That purpose was to make life better for his friends, his family, and for the world. Lem really wanted to reinforce that, Blake told me, and I think he did. In many ways, Lem was a father to me, Bobby later wrote, and he was the best friend I will ever have. I thank God that we have had him, because if we had not, we would never begin. I thank God that we had him, because if we had not, we would never begin to dream what we had missed. And that is the end of chapter 7. Chapter 8 is called A Personal Breakthrough, and I will do that on the next episode. Thanks for listening.